Shall we start, everybody? Could I just remind everyone and tell anyone who wasn't here last week that this is the last of these lectures this term because I've got to go on all these fundraising activities from next week. So I'm compressing four lectures into three, essentially. In this lecture, I want to draw conclusions, really, from what I've been talking about in the rest, that is, where do we stand politically at the end of the century? Well, intellectually and culturally, I would take it, everyone here knows where we stand. Where we live intellectually is in what you could call a time of endings. There is, after all, the end of the century. There is famously being down the road from the dome, the end of the millennium. We can't really work out quite how far these things cast a shadow over intellectual culture, but Western intellectual culture anyway, for the past 15, 20 years, at least, has been dominated by the theme of endings. These lectures have been about endings, the end of Marxism, the end of socialism, or at least these ideas which dominated for so long coming up against an apparent brick wall. But if you look at the literature of the last few years, I think you can find there isn't probably a single institution in modern societies which someone hasn't written a book about declaring that it's come to an end. They have books on the end of work, the end of the family, the end of the nation state, the end of history, which I'll come on to in a minute. There is a famous book on the end of science, and there is even a book, incidentally, about the millennium called The End of Time. This is a culture preoccupied with endings. We don't know, and we won't know perhaps for 2 or 3 years whether this is the shadow of the ending of millennium or not. On the whole, I think not. I think we're in a serious period of massive reappraisal of the intellectual legacy of the late 18th century and of modernity with which I began these lectures. The end of Marxism and the end of socialism mean something significant, really, I think, about the structural transformations of the world in which we live. The most famous book written about these endings is the one on the end of history, which I'm sure many people here will know, written by Francis Fukuyama. Fukuyama wrote an article in 1990, shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall. This article was called The End of History. Subsequently, he wrote a world bestseller called The End of History and the Last Man. The End of History and the Last Man. Fukuyama's thesis was violently attacked by many people, but broadly speaking, it seems to be true. Fukuyama seemed to put his finger on the dilemmas of our epoch, or at least he did to me. The argument which Fukuyama put forward is not that we've come to an end of history, of course, in the sense of an end of all change. It would be ridiculous. It's not an end of history in the sense in which there won't be an unfolding of events and all sorts of new things going on and that kind of thing. He meant an end of history in the Marxian or Hegelian sense, an end of history in the sense in which Marx looked to declare the end of history, but where the end of history did not mean the triumph of socialism, as Marx and I think almost everybody else thought it might do, the end of history meant the triumph of capitalism. Fukuyama's end of history is an end of a period in which anyone can see serious alternatives to the two main organizational parameters of modernity as it spreads across the world, as it becomes globalized. First, capitalism as a competitive market system, or if you like, a market economy, if you want to put it that way. I think it is true to say that at the moment, there is no single body of coordinated and persuasive economic or political thought which sees an alternative to capitalism. We, of course, can discuss, and I will discuss later on, how you might mute or control or humanize capitalism, but no one at the moment sees a structural alternative in world society, apart from those who would opt out of it. Of course, Islamic fundamentalism, in a certain sense, sees an alternative. And of course, there are still sectarian Marxists who say, well, the revolution will come eventually. But there is no central body of thought with political purchase on the electorate or major movements which at the moment can diagnose a society beyond an economy beyond a market economy. Second, democracy. No one at the moment, I think, can see any version of Marx's radicalization of democracy which goes beyond liberal democratic institutions. What you can see is what I discussed last time, that is the possibility of an elaboration of democracy above the level of the nation, the possibility of decentralized democracy, even the possibility of forms of direct democracy, and the transformation of national politics to make it more democratic, even in liberal democratic countries than it is. But you can't any longer see a kind of effective version of some kind of radical new look democracy beyond all these. There isn't one, or if there is one, no one at the moment has a plausible version of it, a plausible vision of it. History, therefore, in a sense, has come to a halt. And living in the West, which is geared to a progressivist view of history, living in a globalized society, which is also geared to the idea that history is linear, that it goes somewhere, that it leads to some kind of progressive movement, it's quite hard to live with the consequences of all this. They don't mean, however, an end to politics. They don't mean an end to government. They mean surely a new look at what politics is and what its possibilities are for us, when what Marx wanted, a kind of control of history, is foreclosed. I think it's important to see that it is foreclosed. We can surely try and regulate our world. We can surely try and still try and adapt our world to human values and interests. But the Marxian idea that we can conquer history, I think, has turned out to be logically false idea. And with it falls a good deal of the totalizing political schemes of which Marx was an example. The reason is that Marx had this simple Enlightenment theorem. Marx was an Enlightenment philosopher. The Enlightenment theorem was the more we get to know history, the more we can control our history. The more we have a scientific outlook on the world, the more we can control the world of nature. Can't even control this microphone, let alone the world of nature. It seems there's a blind spot in the middle there. Someone said last year that I pirouetted round a circle. Well, the reason is there's a kind of blind spot for the mic somewhere in the middle there. This dream of Marx, which seems on the surface, I think, so sensible, as we get to know more about ourselves, as we get to know more about nature, why can't we simply control our history? The reason is that new knowledge brings new uncertainty. The idea that the accumulation of ourselves or the accumulation of knowledge about nature brings certainty is not a correct idea. Of course, it brings more certainty in some areas of our lives. Of course, it allows us to do things technologically which no generation could do before. And these things are indeed radical, including, say, the radical implications of genetic engineering in our time. But anyone who looks, just take that as an example of genetic engineering, can see the progress of genetic engineering is not the same as the progress of human certainty and control. Much more mixed than that, because scientific innovation brings new uncertainties, new risks, if you like, which actually no one has had to deal with, because no one knows what the hell the consequences will be of genetic engineering or even the genetic modification of plant structures in the world. It is impossible to know before the event. Science, therefore, brings uncertainty, not just certainty. And the same thing is true of our knowledge of ourselves, because since we are reflexive beings, and since the history of a globalizing society is increasing reflexivity, that means that as we incorporate knowledge of about ourselves into our actions, we actually change the world which that knowledge originally described. It's a characteristic feature of a reflexive society. The intrusion of knowledge into the environment of action it describes can, in principle, change that environment of action. There is therefore not a stable knowledge environment to know when we seek to know our own history. And that's why, in a highly reflexive world, there are so many new unpredictabilities. The very events of 1989, as I mentioned, were not predicted. No one predicted the East Asian crisis. It's important to see that this is a structural inability, not a contingent one. More knowledge will not change it, because if the Asian crisis were easy to predict, either there would not have been an Asian crisis, or the stock market would be negated. The very idea of risk, of course, presumes uncertainty. That's the way in which global stock markets, capitalistic markets function. There must be lots of unknowns, otherwise they couldn't work at all, because everyone is making risk calculations. So although we live in a world we can try and control aspects of our lives, the idea that we can simply subordinate history and nature to human ambition is an idea that has to be discarded. It was the Enlightenment ambition of the 20th century, of the 18th century, which in the 20th century we have to retract from. Where does this leave us politically? Well, it leaves with a double crisis, I think. There is, of course, the crisis of socialism. It's not only a crisis at the moment, it seems to be a terminal case. You are here talking, as it were, so far as one can see, about a genuine ending. Not an ending of the values of socialism, which I'll come back to in a minute, but so far as one can see, the ending of the ambition of socialism, which was always economic, defining feature, at least of Marx's socialism, was that a managed economy is more effective and rational than a market economy. This does not, so far as we know, appear to be the case. A market economy is the only effective, moderately rational, wealth-creating economy which we know. Of course, there could be reversions and so forth, opt-outs and so on, but that's not the same thing. Socialism is still around, I think, because the values of socialism will not go away. Contesting inequality, creating social solidarity, protecting the vulnerable, having a role for active government, as I would see it, these are socialist values or left of center values. Those values surely will not themselves go away, even though the economic theory which underlay them has done so. The crisis of socialism is therefore one fundamental feature of the late modern world, combined with the broader crisis of enlightenment, which anyone trying to rethink left of center politics, or indeed any form of politics, has to come to terms with. But there is also an equivalent crisis of conservatism, which is surely evident. When you look around in the parochial politics of this country, or whether you look at the fate of conservative parties in Europe at the moment, or whether you look at the problems of conservatism worldwide. Where does this crisis come from? Well, of course, partly it comes from the loss of an opponent. If you don't have a strong Marxist movement any longer, if you only have residual Marxism in the empty ideology of the Chinese Communist Party, you don't have a challenging Marxist movement. If you no longer have an effective socialist economic theory, well, of course, conservatism has lost its chief antagonist, because, as you probably know, the word conservatism only came into being in the late 18th century as a challenge to the French Revolution. Conservatism said, hey, wait a bit, there's a lot in the past that's valuable. We need to sustain traditions, and you lot are galloping along much too fast and in a bloodthirsty way for us who want to sustain the values of the past. That's what conservatism has been about, with many changes along the way. But now what's happened, I think, over the last 20 or so years, the period I'm talking about, conservatism, is at least some central forms of conservatism have become thoroughly paradoxical and self-destructive. This self-destructive quality depends upon a flawed analysis of the world just as much as, or almost the same degree as socialism does. And it stands behind the local difficulties of the Tory party in this country as much as the more generic problems of conservatism. The paradox comes from the embrace of a free market ideology by conservatives. Now, of course, in the US, there long has been a kind of a dominant free market conservatism. In other countries, it's much more recent. And in the US, as in other countries, it's become much more kind of radical embrace than it ever was previously. What it leads to is a thoroughly schizophrenic view of the world, I think, that conservative thinkers hold. On the one hand, many conservative thinkers now advocate radical free markets. They are, in George Soros's term, market fundamentalists. It's important to remember that conservatism was once against the market. In the 19th century, the partial exception of some American conservatives, conservatism was always heavily hostile to the idea of markets, because of their commercialization of life, and because markets were seen as destructive. Well, markets are like this. This is what markets do. Modern conservatism embraces them, however. So modern conservatives tend to say, well, let's all be radical individuals in the marketplace. We can all act according to individualistic values. And the whole point of a marketplace is the furtherance of aggressive individualism. However, they then want to say, let's stick with tradition in the areas of the family, the nation, traditional customs, gender relations, other aspects of life outside of the market. It's not a feasible project, I think. You can't expect people to be individualistic in one domain and then mysteriously solidary in the other. Moreover, market forces are destructive of tradition. The more you unleash markets without any control or regulation, the more destructive they tend to be of established patterns of behavior. You can see this easily in the impact of market-led technological change. In an era of high technological change like we now live in, you can't simply stick with your old life habits, because you're not going to have a stable job in many sectors of the economy. Whole sectors of the economy can be wiped out overnight by technological change. So conservatives too are forced to say, well, you can't just stick with the past, you've got to be adaptable, you've got to be forward-looking, you've got to be able to change. We can't say that in the economy and not say it in the family, for example, in my view. Therefore, the only project which is feasible for us is a modernizing project in terms of both the economy and other structures of society, including the family. Since it makes no sense to try to combine a modern capitalistic economy with a traditional family, or in quotes, traditional family, it therefore follows that a modernizing family policy must go along with economic modernization. What a modernizing family policy to me is an extension of the democratic principles I talked about last time. That the binding premise of family policy, I think, should be equality of the sexes, plus the empowerment and legal protection of children. Traditional family was never equal between the sexes. The traditional family never allowed children in most cultures many rights, certainly not rights enshrined in law. You can't have a traditional family in the context of the kind of society which is emerging, at least in my view, unless you opt out into a certain sector or you become a fundamentalist. Fundamentalism in Western cultures and around the edges of Western cultures is a kind of reaction, really, to all of these changes. Conservatism, therefore, seems to me to be incoherent, or at least what you'd normally call the neoliberal or market fundamentalist version of conservatism, or call it Thatcherism, or call it Reaganism, seems to me incoherent and self-destructive as a political philosophy. We therefore have to ask, where does one go from there in attempts at political reconstruction? The neoliberal answer over the past 20 or so years is nowhere, I think, because the neoliberals, the market fundamentalists, see little role for government. They think the world can be run as though it were a gigantic marketplace, or as though a gigantic marketplace could be run according to purely economic principles of exchange. I think we've seen over the past 2 years with the travails of the East Asian economies and the immense volatility of the world economy, it doesn't make such sense, really, to hold such a view. I went to these famous Davos meetings last weekend, and the Davos ethos has changed in 2 years. A couple of years ago, everyone was a market fundamentalist. Now no one is a market fundamentalist. You have Robert Rubin, the US Secretary of the Treasury, saying that he's now discovered the most important thing in economic development is actually the role of government. Well, there's a big transition. However, you can't recover government in the old sense, I think. So where do we go with this dilemma? This is the subject of the concluding part of this lecture and concluding part of this lecture series. First of all, does it make any sense any longer to say there is a left and a right in politics as a broad backdrop to all this? Does the division between left and right disappear? This issue has been being discussed for something like the past 20 or so years, since all these changes, especially those associated with globalization, started occurring. Probably the most intense debate about the division between left and right has occurred in Italy. And if anyone's interested in this issue, I'd recommend the book by Bobbio, Norberto Bobbio, called Left and Right. Norberto Bobbio. Left and Right is a little slim book which became publishing sensation in Italy. It sold about 200,000 copies in the first few months after it was published. Can you imagine that in the UK? No, you cannot, I think. It would have to be about gardening or something for us. You know, if Delia Smith had written it. This culture has a long way to go, I think, in political sophistication. Anyway, in Italy it became a great bestseller. And in many countries in Europe, apart from this one, it was also a bestseller. Bobbio says there still is division between left and right. Is he correct about this? I think he is partly correct. I take it as obvious that when you have the disappearance of a world historical alternative to capitalism, when you no longer have Marxism except as a very restricted fundamentalist set of residual sects, as it were, when socialism has disappeared itself largely from the face of history except as a series of crucial values, then it's plain that division between left and right can't be as all-embracing as it used to be, because that division was found around the idea that conservatism resists progressivism. Progressivism meant taking control of history. It meant producing a society beyond capitalism. Well, if there is no society or no economy beyond capitalism, then of course the divisions between left and right can't be as all-embracing as they used to be. This is certainly how it seems to me. On the other hand, I think Bobbio is right, or is correct, I should say, to claim that these divisions do not and will not disappear. They don't and they won't disappear for two reasons. First of all, there is a genuine division in value outlook and the values one holds, I think, between right and left, and I briefly touched on that earlier. Second, there is an interesting kind of redefinition of right and left around responses to globalization. And I'll just very briefly say a bit about each of these things. In terms of values, I think it makes sense to argue within the limits of the kind of more restricted division between left and right that Bobbio is roughly correct in what he says about the values of the left. I think if you're left of center, and you're never going to get a precise definition of these things, but if you're left of center, first of all, you believe in social justice, that is, you believe that however it be defined, and of course it is a very contentious issue in modern politics, but however it be defined, you should not let a society become too unequal. There should be norms of social justice which somehow specify some limits to inequality in a society, economic inequality and other forms of inequality. Very difficult to say what limits. Big debate raging, of course, about what social justice might mean in a post-socialist society, but it seems to me it's a fundamental belief of the left. I would tend to say the same thing is also true of social solidarity, although that's a bit more dubious. That is, I think those on the left of center, or those on the left, give a good deal of prominence to the importance of the community or the larger society for individual development. They see us all developing in a larger society on which we're all dependent for our individuality. I think if you're left of center, you tend to reject the idea that society can be reduced by isolated individuals. You see society and community as a significant value in itself. Although there are some strands of conservatism which has also, I think, believe this, so not so. These things are never going to be precise dividing lines. Third, I think protection of the vulnerable. That is, I think, seems to me to be a key feature of left of center politics, that you have an ethos of care, C-A-R-E, care. That is, you recognize that in any society there are people, whether through fault of their own or not, who suffer significant deprivations, and that people in such situations need active protection from the wider community, whether this be economic support, medical care, or other kinds of protection for the elderly and the infirm and so forth. Finally, I think if you're on the left, you believe in active government. That is, you think that government can take action to have some effect around each of these three prior sets of values, that the role of government, it may not be decisive, it may not be ultimate, but nevertheless that use of government in the broadest sense, you can help to achieve a society which is relatively equal, which is relatively inclusive, and which is solidary, which holds together, and which is tolerant of potentially diverse or different cultural beliefs. If you're on the right, I think you tend to hold different values. Many people on the right reject the very idea of social justice, as the famous right liberal von Hayek, when he was teaching here, did. Von Hayek simply said there is social justice is not a coherent idea. I think you see society tend to in more individualistic terms, a matter of, you know, the individual gets out there, gets on with it. If bad things befall him or her, well, that's tough luck. So it's a hard world. And the same thing would apply to protection of the vulnerable. But you can find strands of these things in conservative philosophy, so you're not going to find any longer a complete and utterly clear division between left and right. It is still, however, I think, fairly important division. And it tends to be, as I mentioned, restructured in relation to the globalization debate that I discussed previously. I would say all around the world there is a new far right emerging. The new far right denies most of these values, or all of them, and the new far right defines itself in relation to a certain reaction to globalization. The new far right couples economic protectionism, it's hostile to globalization, it couples economic protectionism to cultural protectionism, where cultural protectionism is defined in racist or xenophobic terms. The new far right says globalization is destructive, we want nothing of it, we need to protect the purity of the nation, we need to stop immigration or return immigrants to their home countries, we need to protect the individual identity of the local culture, and so on. All the way through from Le Pen to Ross Perot to Pauline Hanson in Australia, all over the world you find a certain sort of coordination of beliefs around this idea on the right, even going through to the American patriots, you know, the radical far right, who say the United Nations is a threat to the authenticity of the US and there should be no international organizations and so forth and so forth. I think you also have a division on the left. I mean, you have more than one division, but you have a division on the left between, you know, it's a sort of prejudicial terms, but if you don't mind me using them, the old left. People on the old left don't like to be called the old left naturally, so sort of pre-existing left, socialist left, if you like, and what I'd call the modernizing left. Largely defined, I think, in relation to analysis and reaction to globalization. The old left, as I mentioned, when discussing globalization, tends to reject the very phenomenon. They tend to say either that globalization is destructive, as the right does, and then says, well, we need to opt out and reinforce the welfare state, so forth and so forth. Or denies the very existence of the phenomenon, therefore says, well, business as usual. Welfare state, European social model, all these things can continue. The modernizing left, to which I belong, argues that globalization, much better term, is a real phenomenon, that it does produce the kinds of changes I've been trying to analyze in the last three lectures, and that we need a left of center response to it. So I would say that if you stand on the left, at least in the political position I do, you're looking for a left of center response to globalization. In other words, you're rejecting the neoliberal, and of course, for me, the far right model for response to globalization. You're looking for political response to globalization, which stresses the values of social justice, solidarity, protection, but recognizes the realities of the new global order and argues that this must involve both a modernization and reconstruction of politics, in which quite a few issues go beyond left and right, because if left and right, as I tried to say, still have a purchase, but there are many concrete issues of policy which seem to me don't fit with left-right divisions. It's futile not to recognize this. Left and right is still a useful division for some fields of politics, but not for others. I think some of the most fundamental things we have to face, ecological issues, for example, or indeed, redefining full employment, job creation, are not in any definitive sense left-right issues any longer. They're issues over which there can be a collaboration across the political center. That's why I quite like the idea of the radical center or revision of radical politics, because I think it is possible to get consensual support or broad support in a society for quite radical measures, where radical doesn't necessarily correspond to a left-right division, simply means taking innovative measures in relation to profound problems. Again, more or less the whole field of ecological issues, I think, belongs to this domain of politics. You need radical thinking, but that radical thinking is not really of a left or right variety, or only partly overlaps with it. Out of all this, there comes this famous signifier, or now infamous signifier, of third way politics. Third way politics is a kind of struggled across the world, this term third way. But what it means to me anyway, I mean, it doesn't matter to me whether you use the term third way politics or not, because the term third way has been used many times before in the history of political theory, sometimes by right-wing as well as left-wing groups. It doesn't matter whether you use it. I use it because it's become quite convenient and well-known. And what it means is how you develop a left politics which takes a positive response to globalization, how you develop a left politics which sustains the values I mentioned earlier, but acknowledges that the old economic and social policies often don't work in the new era with such profound transformations going on around us. Another way, therefore, of saying what third way politics is, or what it means for me, is simply modernized social democracy. Modernized social democracy. Social democratic politics. Sorry, democracy, that was supposed to be. Social democratic politics after the end of socialism, sustaining socialist values and applying them to a globalized world. Third way politics, I find a handy way of saying this. There is a kind of political agenda emerging under the third politics label. One shouldn't associate it specifically with Tony Blair or with any particular politician. This is a global dialogue, because no one thinks, I think, very few people think, you can any longer go back to bureaucratic top-down government of the sort associated with post-war socialism and Marxism. Fewer and fewer people now think you can simply say, well, if government can't solve our problems, then markets can solve our problems. You can see all around you that markets create problems, not just resolve them, and that they need an institutional framework. You see from the example of Russia what happens if you have a society without effective taxation system. The idea that you can simply reduce taxes and have an effective civic culture is not a starter as a cogent political idea. So there is a kind of agenda to third way politics, which was sort of developed in the European context, the context of European social democracy, in the context of the fact that there are 13 out of 15 governments, after all, so left or center governments in power in EU countries, but which is generalizable. Some aspects of third way politics, I think, are generalizable to many other parts of the world. Since this is the last 10 minutes, as it were, talking about endings, let me just briefly sketch out what the main parameters of third way politics are as I see them. First, reconstruction of government. Third way politics argues for active government, in contrast to neoliberals, argues that in a globalizing world we need more government, not less, but government should no longer be identified either solely with national government or with bureaucratic top-down, top-heavy administration. We need active government which is dynamic. We need to recognize that the dynamism of some business organizations can be reproduced in public settings. As part of the reconstruction of active government, you also need a new defense of public institutions. Third way politics argues for a resurgence of public institutions, the defense of public space, but claims that you should not identify the public with the government. traditional socialism tended to identify public institutions with government-owned or government-dominated institutions. There are many ways of reconstructing public space in which government can play a part, but in which it is not even necessarily the dominant actor. So, for example, government can contribute to the refurbishment of urban areas, the regeneration of urban areas, without subordinating these to the control of some government bureaucracy. Many ways in which one can do this. Part and parcel of the reconstruction of government has to be the democratizing of democracy, that I talked about before. There's a generic problem of trust in government, which means that government must be brought back in touch with people's everyday needs. It is possible, I believe, to do this. Second, reconstruction of civil society. The resurgence of civil society is a major theme of third wave politics. Civil society means the areas, if you like, outside of the economy and outside of government. Third sector or voluntary sector associations, the family and other non-economic organizations. Third wave politics argues that you need an active collaboration between government, civil society or third sector associations and other agencies, including sometimes business or industrial organizations. Neoliberals made a mistake about civil society because they tend to argue, well, government should just get out of civil society and then there'll be social solidarity, there'll be harmony and so forth. Well, that is surely not the case. Old-style socialism argued for the replacement of civil society by government. tended to argue that government is more effective than third sector or voluntary groups and should replace them. That's what happened in quite a few welfare states, and that was a defining feature of East European socialism too. We need the active hand of government to refurbish civic culture, to reconstruct everyday civility. These things have been shown to have a direct impact on crime. Countering crime shouldn't be primarily a means of high technology police forces. It should be primarily integrated with local community refurbishment. This is absolutely not something limited to Western countries. We have many examples from Brazil, other countries in South America, Africa, of local community refurbishment had a strong impact on crime rates and indeed on the kind of everyday civility of life and on poverty in these communities where these experiments have been tried. We should generalize some of these. I don't have enough time to talk about them in detail. Third, reconstruction of the economy. I would say what we're looking for in third wave politics is what I call a new mixed economy. The old mixed economy was based around the antithesis between markets and a centralizing government. It was based upon a struggle between how much the government should own and control and how much private corporation should own and control. A new mixed economy is really finding a balance between deregulation and regulation on a local, national, and global level. Simply a mistake of neoliberalism to equate deregulation with freedom. It's not the case that to deregulate markets inevitably increases human freedom, let alone the resources with which you create human freedoms. Regulation can often create freedom. You can see this in the way, for example, regulation of media space could actually make possible a much more effective dialogue than when you have a few individual media owners who simply dominate and invade that media space. You need regulation to protect economic space as well as other spaces. Third, reconstruction of the welfare state. Third wave politics, I think, looks for a society of care, that is a society which protects the vulnerable, but argues that the old welfare state was often inefficient, wasn't very good actually at reducing inequalities, for example, this has been demonstrated, was a bureaucratic top-down system, was often alienating to its recipients, was often a control mechanism for the poor. The welfare state kind of originated actually with Bismarck as a control system for the poor, a way of controlling people rather than really providing them with benefits. Welfare reform, at least in my view, should not mean spending less on the welfare state. It should mean spending it more effectively. And we should look to find a kind of new balance between risk and security, because in lots of respects, we live in more democratic societies than used to exist previously. Even a single thing like the emancipation of women has made such a difference to that, the sphere of the family and elsewhere. In a society of freedom, you must have also a notion of individual responsibility, but you need to find a kind of balance between that and collective responsibility, which welfare systems provide. We do have a good guide, I think, about the possibilities of welfare reform, even though in practice welfare reform is very difficult. In societies which don't have welfare states, the same principle applies, I think. Those societies too need welfare. East Asian economies, by and large, don't have welfare states. They need welfare institutions. It doesn't follow they have to go through the route of the Western welfare state, however, to achieve those institutions. But if you don't have a society which protects people, you don't have a viable society in the long run. That must be made compatible with recognition of individual freedom and initiative, of which a certain amount more is needed in some non-Western cultures, I think, than exists at the moment. There's still strong authoritarian residues, for example, in some East Asian states, not to mention states elsewhere. Fifthly, ecological reform. The dominant theme here, really interesting one, I think, is the idea that, again, I'm sure some people will know, of ecological modernization. The idea of ecological modernization comes from Germany originally, from the debate about 15 years ago involving the Green Movement. It used to be thought by most ecological thinkers that economic development and ecological principles are incompatible. The one is bought at the expense of the other. This is not true. There are many ways in which ecological protection, environmental sophistication, generates jobs, creates economic growth, rather than standing in counter to it. We need to find ways in which you can make a non-zero-sum game of economic development and ecological protection. And again, we have numerous strategies from the discussion of ecological modernization about how to do so. Sixthly, the transformation of the global system. In a globalizing world, if you take globalization seriously, as I try to insist one must do, you can't simply respond on a local or national level. You must respond on a global level. There is, I believe, for the first time, the political will to get some way towards this. You'd be looking for two things. You'd be looking for transnational democratization of the kind that I mentioned when I talked about it in my lecture. And you'd be looking for greater governance of the world economy. Two or three years ago, you would have said this is not a prospect. Now, it is almost inevitability. There will be greater governance in the global economy. We don't know as yet just how it will be, how the will of the nations can be drawn together to achieve it, but achieve it in some sense. I think they will. I think there will be greater economic governance coupled to, in the best scenario, an expansion of democratization above the level of the nation. These things taken together, I think, provide the beginnings of a left politics which can respond to globalization and which can carry us through, as it were, nationally, locally, and to some extent globally. What they don't do is provide an alternative, and I like to leave you with this thought. Fukuyama says it's an end of history, and I've said in this lecture that I believe one has to accept that this is so. Accepting that it is so for the moment does not mean, I think, accepting that this is an ultimate situation of humanity. It seems to me that if you go back full circle, where I started out talking about Marx, that many of the things that Marx argued about capitalism are true. That is, capitalism produces a commodified society which commercializes values, which produces individual competition, sometimes noxious competition, which produces very radical technological change, which is very disturbing, I think, in terms of its impact on people's lives, and which is a chaotic type system with enormous volatility in it. You have to therefore think that in the end, this isn't the end of history, even though this is where I started the lecture. That is, at some future point, there will surely emerge a new political philosophy which will find some kind of alternative to a capitalistic economy. And I believe this will be an ecological one. That is, it won't simply be a rejection of capitalism. It will be a way of finding a more sensitive lifestyle for humanity in the context, against the backdrop of the kind of society that capitalism has produced. And, you know, this is where I started. Marx said it, you still need to find the heart of the heartless world. That is the task, I think, for political philosophy 21st century. So thanks very much for coming. Sorry about the last lecture, but hopefully look forward to seeing many of you around the institution. Thanks very much.